And we are, as a people, inherently and historically
wake up.
Opposed to secret societies, the secret oaths, and the secret proceedings.
The show that asks questions about why we don't ask questions.
What the hell is going on?
This is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park.
Welcome to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. These are Conspiracy Queries. I am Alan Park, and thanks for getting some great feedback to the show, everybody. A lot of folks out there. One person in particular was not too happy, and that's okay. Let's talk about that for a minute. He was upset that that I was saying something on the show, that I was talking to the guest, and he was suggesting that I might let the guest talk more. And I got to say, like, every time we have a guest on the show, it's about the guest. I start off with a little rant about something politically, perhaps, but not always. And then we do get to the guest. And the guest makes up the lion's share of the show, as you've heard. So maybe suggesting one thing only. If you're listening to a show called Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park and you're not really enjoying Alan Park, I guess you're listening to the wrong show. Okay? Tell that to Jon Stewart, The Daily Show, and Late Night with David Letterman. If you don't like those guys, you don't really watch that show. So, thanks, qualified listener, for that wonderful tip. Basically comes back to don't listen to what you don't like. But thanks for getting back to us, so I know folks like you are out there. Well, here we are in Canada, sweltering. It's lovely for me, anyway. I know a lot of people don't like it. There's a lot of heat on, and a lot of people can't take the heat. Case in point, our supposed leader, who isn't Canada PM Stephen Harper. Boy, this guy just stirs it up all the time. Usually because he's wrong and not really represented by the majority that he claims to be. So I guess that's a big old example of being a liar and getting away with it. And now, the Aboriginal community is really pressing hard for him to recognize that many Aboriginal women are missing. And he's kind of not really addressing that. Although flying up to the Arctic and claiming some kind of sovereignty for Canada. Thanks. That's great. And also a distraction. So I appreciate that. But Harper's told that reporters that Aboriginal women are 3.5 times more likely to experience violence. This is from beforeitsnews.com. Than non-Aboriginal women, 3.5 times more likely. And he says they are clearly and empirically outnumbered by Aboriginal women that aren't missing or murdered. Isn't that great? Isn't that fantastic? Yes. And there are so many days that go by in our history that aren't about the detonation of nuclear bombs. But we still have had those times and we still have to pay attention to those and maybe not do that kind of thing again. So hopefully the electorate is waking up. And I know this doesn't include everybody, but I hope it includes enough people to flush this old blue turd down the bowl, man. It's time to finish it up. This guy is an absolute raving lunatic, as I am often accused of being, but at least I'm not like damaging people's lives and taking their money while I put out my point of view that does so often and so regularly counter the official story, because we all know the official story is nonsense. And guess what? The official story is the narrative of oh so many movies in Hollywood. And with us today on the show, our guest is Robert Sullivan IV. He is making a return visit, the author of The Royal Arch of Enoch. We spoke with him, episode 47, something like that. He's got a new book now called Cinema Symbolism. And you'll learn on the show, it's Cinema Symbolism 1. He's got another one coming. This guy is prolific and super well-researched, as I do comment on the show. It kind of blows me away, but he's got a lot of cool things to say about movies you probably love, have maybe heard of, at least if you don't love them. And even The Exorcist, Back to the Future, Star Wars, of course, with the Joseph Campbell mythology at its roots. This is an entertaining show. And if you like movies and research, let's tune into our favorite Freemason, Robert Sullivan. And here he is with us right now on Skype. Let's go to our interview. Robert, you've joined us before. You were talking about, I think it was about Oh, gosh. Episode 40-something? Wow. Anyway, nice to have you back. You had the Temple of Enoch, was it, the last time?
That's right. That's right. It was. I was on with you, I want to say, back in February or March of 2014 this year. That was the Royal Arch of Enoch, my book on esoteric Freemasonry. And thank you for having me back on Conspiracy Queries. It's great to be back with you. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great. We had a very interesting show last time, and I'm sure we will possibly touch on some of that. But today, you're talking about a completely different book, and you're on the show for a lot of different reasons. So tell us what that is.
Yeah, I'm pleased to announce that I've just recently published, and I mean very recently, this has only been within the last month, my brand new book entitled Cinema Symbolism, A Guide to Esoteric Imagery in Popular Movies. This book, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but this book was born out of the final chapter of the Royal Arch of Enoch. This was the book I was on talking about last time, esoteric Freemasonry. Make a long story super short. About the final chapter of the Royal Arch of Enoch delved into what I would best describe as Masonic Enochian solar symbolism in movies such as the National Treasure films, Being There, Excalibur, the King Arthur movie, that's a solar allegory, the Vinci
Code.
We're going to have to hit
these a little more slowly, because I want to spend a little time on each one of them, so I'm catching you now before we get too busy.
Yeah, that's okay. These were some movies that I delved into in the Royal Arch of Enoch book. It's the final chapter of the Royal Arch of Enoch. Things like the Da Vinci Code, which has a lot of the number 13 in it. At any rate, when I was writing this final chapter, there was a lot more movies that I wanted to talk about that I knew just from watching them and having studied this material for 20 years, was incorporating elements of alchemy, numerology, astrology, mythology, in them, and naturally I couldn't have a 470-page chapter in the Royal Arch, so I finished the Royal Arch of Enoch book with some of those movies I was just talking about, and Cinema Symbolism, A Guide to Esoteric Imagery is my brand new book that talks about these same Kabbalistic, astrological, occult themes in popular movies.
Well, before we get too far into this, I'm already fascinated. I guess you've seen a lot of movies and done a lot of research. Tell us first, before we get too busy, where we can get this book.
Yeah, Cinema Symbolism, A Guide to Esoteric Imagery is out now. If you go to my website, the easiest way to do this is to go to my website, which is www.robertwsullivaniv.com. My name is Robert W. Sullivan IV, so my website is Robert W. Sullivan with two L's, IV, that's the letter IV.com. If you go there, there's a banner on the homepage. You can click on that. That will take you to my publisher site. I've received a lot of emails about acquiring signed copies of my books. So if you want the signed copies, you can buy those through my publisher's website. They're sold exclusively there. It's also on the Amazon Kindle, the Barnes & Noble Nook, the Apple iBookstore. There are links to all of these on my website. You can get the paperback from Amazon as well, but it won't be signed. Again, if you want, or the Royal Arch of Enoch. Again, the signed copies are sold exclusively through my website, which is a link to my publisher site. And again, it's in the Kindle ebook on Amazon, the Barnes & Noble Nook,
okay,
the Apple iBookstore.
So
all there.
It's fairly available then. Okay, good.
It is completely available.
Okay. Right. So tell us about your connection with why you went this way. What, you know, coming out of the Royal Temple of Enoch, why, how, what was the path directly from that to referencing movies in modern times and what they connect to, according to you and your research?
Right, right. When I was doing the Royal Arch of Enoch book, it's a book about esoteric Freemasonry. We talked about this before in the last podcast about this historical anomaly going on. I mean, I trace the history and the anomaly of this, you know, of the Masonic history, the incorporation, the development of this higher degree ceremonial, you know, in its origins, how it incorporates the Book of Enoch. I get into the history of the United States, this Masonic history. And I wanted to bring the Royal Arch of Enoch up into modern days. I mean, I sort of, the last portion of the book is when I get into the United States of America, how Freemasonry was being used to develop and cultivate the United States of America. I get into the arcane you know, esoteric architecture of things like Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland, New York City. I get into all this. And the final chapter was this. I wanted to bring the book up into modern times. So I thought, well, the best way for me to do this is talk about, you know, this sort of Masonic, Enochian solar symbology going on in popular movies. And I just limited it to these movies such as the National Treasure movies, Being There, Excalibur, you know, some of these movies, you know, I just mentioned. That's where the Royal Arch of Enoch ends.
Tell us about Being There. Let's just jump in. Being There is a fantastic film, one of my favorites of all time, with one of my comedic heroes, Peter Sellers. Tell us the connection.
Right. Well, Being There is, for lack of a better word, a solar allegory. Peter Sellers, interestingly, was a Freemason, by the way. And Sellers, in Being There, this is something I dissect in the Royal Arch of Enoch, and this is something I also bring up in Cinema Symbolism. You have what you call your solar journey, your solar allegory, where Chauncey Gardner is the Sun Man. This is reflected coming out of the Bible, which, you know, incorporates a lot of solar astrological symbolisms. Some say the Bible, and I present evidence of this in the Royal Arch of Enoch, is nothing but astrology.
Right.
Right. So you have Chauncey Gardner, the Sun Man, who drones on and on about the equinoxes and the solstices, about gardening, how plants die in winter and they're born again in the spring, and then you call cultivate them in the spring and the summer, harvest them in the fall and then winter, and everything dies again. And he, you know, it's just endless, you know, parables or speaking in mysteries, you know, of the equinoxes and the solstices. But he's providing light, you know, as the sun or enlightenment, because people misunderstand this stuff.
Right.
And they think he's actually talking wisdom, but he's actually just talking about the solstices and the equinoxes and paralleling the Bible. You know, he hangs around with the first woman, Eve, who is Shirley MacLaine or Eve
right.
Grant.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then you have this sort of Masonic Enochian, or excuse me, Egyptian solarism going on, where the president of the United States is basically seeking the advice of the guy Rand, who is part of this secret cabal who sort of pulls the strings of the president. The president can't do anything without the you know, without seeking out Rand. And of course, Rand turns the president over to Chauncey, believing that he's talking economics, but he's actually just talking about the sun. And of course, at the end of the movie, when you have the, you know, the Rand character being put into the, you know, Egyptian Masonic Illuminati styled crypt at the end, the pyramid with the all seeing eye on it. This is again emblematizing, you know, the resurrected son of Osiris. And you know, as they're putting him in the crypt, the guys over the coffin are talking about, these are the guys in the cabal talking about how they're selecting the next president, not going to elect them, you know, and how they're in control of everything. And of course, this is all part of the Masonic conspiracy that's being insinuated in this film. And just backtracking a little bit, within Freemasonry, of course, the sun is the most important symbol. It's the most important emblem. The Masonic Lodge is laid out based on the sun. I talk about this ad nauseum in the Royal Arch of Enoch. And then at the end of the movie, Gardner, Peter Sellers, performs the miracle of the sun walking on the water,
right,
the light of the sun reflecting off the water. And Chauncey Gardner actually does it, walks across the, you know, the water, the pond of water, the body of water at the end of the movie. So you have this whole sort of Masonic solar allegory going on.
And
with
he walks
being
across,
there.
And as he goes across, he has a long umbrella, and he bends
right.
over and he pokes it into the water, and it does go in, of course, and then he continues
right.
to walk away.
That's absolutely right, Alan. That's his way of showing you that I'm walking across the water, and of course, the sun. This is something I bring up in Cinema Symbolism. I actually have that image of Chauncey Gardner walking across the water at the end of the movie, and the sun lights being reflected across against the body of water.
And what I find fascinating as well with that movie, everything that you're saying, but also the dramatic subtext, is that so many people, characters in the film, just think this guy is an idiot. You know, I mean, he's just an absolute fool through the whole thing. And I think is there any symbology to that? Because
if he's really
setting everything down, as you say, and following those patterns, if most of the people in the film, you know, can't get on board with his thinking, that's sort of telling us about society today.
Well, right. What he's doing is he's reflecting, he's paralleling Jesus Christ, because if you read the Bible, it says Jesus only spoke in riddles and in parables. And if Jesus wasn't speaking in riddles, he wasn't speaking. So that's what Gardner does. I mean, all he does is speak in these riddles that people are completely misinterpreting. And the idea is that this is what's going on in the Bible, is Jesus is just speaking these riddles and people can interpret them any way they want to. And that's exactly what's going on in Being there. So it's parallel. And then, of course, in the New Testament, you have this whole concept of Jesus being the Son Man, the resurrected Son, just being this allegorical symbol for the Son. And this is exactly what Gardner is. It's the same story where Gardner's just speaking in these solar riddles about the equinoxes and the solstices that people are completely interpreting or changing around to whatever they want them to be. And that's what's going on in Being There. And I agree with you. It's one of my favorite movies. It's Sellers' last movie. Sellers was a Freemason. But it's a great film. It's always been one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah. And it's very funny as well.
One more
question about it, though. Let's take it back a step. And it's been a long, long time since I've seen the movie 3 or 4 times, but I read the book a much longer time ago. And I can't speak to comparing the book to the movie. You know, often people say, oh, it's better than the movie. The movie's better. The book's better than the movie, usually what you hear. But in that book, so if he's laying down the same story pretty much, and the film is a faithful adaptation of it, so that means it's more about Jerzy Kosinski, the author of the book's knowledge and or agenda to bring something forward. And then other folks went, hey, yeah, let's make that movie. But obviously the book came first.
You know, that's absolutely a great question. Sometimes the author of a book will incorporate some of this stuff, but a lot of times the filmmaker, because the page is just the written word. So when it gets to the movie, the filmmaker will want to translate the movie and incorporate this symbology that's not in the book. I can think of numerous examples of this where the movie is faithful to the book to a degree, but you will see things in the book, or excuse me, you will see things in the movie that the author never even put in in the written word, because he can't. I mean, sure. It would have just things hanging in the background, things like that.
Oh, and they merged characters together and all kinds of things. And Stephen King had that huge problem with The Shining, even though The Shining is totally different than the books in so many ways. But you know what, Robert? I want to talk about some other movies and dive further into this, but we have to do that in a minute or so. You're listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park on Sirius XM Channel 167. And we are back with Robert Sullivan. We've been going over the Sun allegory movie of Being There, which is starring Peter Sellers, and how it relates to the whole story, isn't it? So we were bringing it back to, as I was saying, Jerzy Kosinski and the author of the book. And you put that forward that, is it basically, is there some kind of a connection between, like, who says, hey, that book that's really heavy with symbolism, we really want to get that into a movie, let's get that made and add those changes, as you said, because they do change sometimes the characters in a book from the book to the movie, or eliminate them because of time reasons and various different changes, and sometimes you get a different thing altogether.
Right. Well, a lot of times, because you're dealing with the written word, a filmmaker can incorporate symbols and things going on in the background that the author never talks about. The Shining, the one you just mentioned before the break, is one of the greatest examples I can think of that does this. Kubrick was obsessed with it and incorporates so many hidden. The Shining is a movie that I talk about in Cinema Symbolism. I'm actually revisiting The Shining and doing much more in depth with it in this book I'm currently writing.
Oh, fascinating.
Called Cinema Symbolism 2, which is the sequel to Cinema Symbolism.
I think that one came out the same year as Being There. I do.
Yeah.
The same time anyway.
Well, right. I think Being There was 79. I think The Shining was 1980. So they're right around one another.
Right.
But I mean, my God, I mean, Kubrick, I mean, what he does with that, I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, it's never ending. The hidden symbolism and imagery he places in that movie. Another one is The Exorcist. William Peter Blatty incorporates, or excuse me, William Friedkin incorporates a lot of hidden iconography in The Shining that you won't pay, that's not in the book. I mean, because you couldn't write it down. I mean,
Wait a second. William Friedkin and The Shining. What was that?
I'm sorry. No, The Exorcist. William Friedkin and The Exorcist.
Oh, okay. He wrote it. He wrote the book.
William Peter Blatty wrote the book.
Oh, right. Sorry. William Peter Blatty wrote the book and Friedkin directed the movie. That's right.
Right, right. And the movie is a pretty faithful adaption of the book.
Yeah.
But Friedkin does the same thing. He incorporates these little nuances and tricks with some of the characters to convey things like Kabbalistic apotheosis and Ascensio and Christ-like figures.
What? I don't know what that is. I have no idea what you're talking about. Thank God.
Well, no. Like, for example, in The Exorcist, Father Karras is the little savior of the little girl.
Right.
He is the sort of Christ-like savior of the little girl. He's her personal Jesus Christ, to quote the Depeche Mode song. Shows you this on the screen by showing you Karras in a forever state of ascension. If you watch The Exorcist, Father Karras is constantly moving upwards. He's always moving up steps, walking upwards. In fact, the first time you see Karras on the screen, he is coming up a flight of steps to a subway platform, and you'll see right behind him, it says 33rd Street. And this is a reference to Jesus Christ, who was on earth 33 years and was crucified at age 33. So what he is showing you is that Karras is going to be this little girl's apotheosis, Christ-like savior. And he does it throughout the entire movie. This constant moving upwards with Karras. You'll find it at the end.
Is that the guy, Dimmy, when his mother shows up on the bed? Is that who Karras is in that?
Yeah, Father Karras was the younger priest.
Right.
He's played by Jason Miller.
Okay.
The older priest was Father Marin, who is played by Max von Sydow.
That's right.
The Father Marin character parallels this Jesuit priest, named Athanasius Kircher, who lived in the 1600s, who was interested in discovering Christianity's pagan origins by digging up tombs, excavating pagan sites. And this is, of course, how Marin starts off the movie, by excavating the pagan site, looking for Christianity's pagan origins. So you'll see a parallel with that. But going back to Karras just real quick.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, well, like at the end, Karras is presented, constantly moving upwards, this sort of savior figure for the little girl. And of course he does. I mean, he at the very end of the movie, he's the one who exorcises the demon from the little girl. But if you pay attention to the movie, Karras is constantly moving upwards. But this is contrasted by his doubt about religion and Christianity that permeates the film. So by saving the little girl at the end, he dies by falling down the flight of steps. So he's constantly moving upwards, yet at the end he dies by going down the flight of steps. And this is, symbolizing his doubt and his skepticism about Christianity that permeates the whole movie. And then when he's dying at the end of the movie, you'll see him at the flight of the steps. If you pay attention, if you look to the wall next to him, you'll see the words pigs written out, P-I-G-S. This parallels the gospel story where Jesus cast the demons into the herd of pigs, successfully exorcising a man, and he cast the demons into the pigs. So you'll see the word pigs written next to Karras. This symbolizes that the exorcism is successful, that the demon has been cast out. But again, symbolizing his doubt and reservations about Christianity, he perishes by falling down the flight of steps. Yet in the movie, he's constantly seen in a state of upwards ascension. And there's a lot more other hidden symbolism going on in The Exorcist. It's probably my favorite horror movie, arguably the greatest horror movie of all time.
Oh, that's a good contender. And Robert, you sure have done your homework. You listen to the way you're telling me all this. Wow, you've done a lot of research on all of these topics.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I did was, it's a great, when I wrote The Royal Arch of Enoch, and I probably mentioned this, if I didn't, I'll do it now. When I did The Royal Arch of Enoch show with you, The Royal Arch of Enoch was basically born out of 20 years of studying, mysticism, the occult, Freemasonry, astrology, Hebrew Kabbalah, Christian Kabbalah with a C, Hermetic Kabbalah, you name it. I mean, I studied this stuff for 20 years, and what I did was I put this 20 years and I applied it to movies. And, when you do this and you sit there and watch a film through a symbolic eye, you're going to see a whole lot of things that will just go by you on a first viewing if you're not paying attention. And believe you me, Alan, when I watch these movies and I'm writing this book, I mean, I have to watch these movies 5-6 times and I'm sitting there with a legal pad in front of me.
Sure.
you know, taking, you know, voracious.
You see more things on subsequent viewings. You pick up, oh, look at that eye at the top of the pyramid there. I didn't see that the first time I saw it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. You will see things that, you know, you will miss completely the first couple go-rounds. The Shining is a movie that is just so overloaded. I mean, we could do a 3-4 hour show on the stuff going on in that. Another one, just real quick, is the I call him the modern day Stanley Kubrick, is Darren Aronofsky.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Black Swan is just so overloaded.
Okay, let's take a little time on Black Swan then. I do want to catch you up on The Shining as well. But
The Shining's great.
Let's cover that as well. I mean, hey, that's what the theme of the show is today, so these things are all relevant and interesting. But do talk about Black Swan, because I'm of two minds of this film, and I'd like to hear what you have to say before I tell you.
Well, there's a lot going on in this film. Black Swan, in fact, is so overloaded with esoteric imagery that I actually had to cut it in half. And I put half of the material in the book that's out now, Cinema Symbolism, and I put the alchemical interpretation of Black Swan in the book I'm writing right now called Cinema Symbolism 2, because in a nutshell, that's what Nina Sayers or Natalie Portman is doing. She's affecting alchemy. She's transmuting herself from one personality to another. She's becoming this Black Swan, demonic yet graceful bird-like creature, which she perfects at the end of the movie. So there's this whole underlying current of alchemy going on with Black Swan, but you have really a lot of Jungian psychology. This is Carl Gustav Jung. You will have the entire theme of the movie is the conscious ego, which is the White Swan persona for Nina Sayers, Natalie Portman, against the shadow self, which is the Black Swan persona. And these two, in a normal person, they exist side by side, but she can only be the one or the other. She can't reconcile both of them. This is what's depicted in the entire movie. What you have going on is Aronofsky shows you this by the use of mirrors in the movie. All the characters in the movie are introduced through the reflection in a mirror. Natalie Portman is not introduced through a reflection of a mirror when she wakes up from a dream. The same mirror reflects the mother character running around in the background. The Mila Kunis Lily character is introduced through her reflection in a glass in the subway train. The Leroy character, the only real male figure in the movie, he is introduced coming down a flight of steps, and there's a reason for that via his reflection. And then Winona Ryder is introduced by smashing a mirror. So you have all the characters being introduced through their mirror reflections. And this is symbolizing the shadow self versus, you know, the reflection, you know, of the darker side reflecting back upon their conscious ego. And in fact, for Nina Sayers, it's so great that the darker side actually comes alive towards the end of the movie in a mirror. I mean, her reflection actually has a life of its own, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. And then you have, then with Jung, you have all these characters, and these are what are called the archetypes. And these come straight out of the word of tarot cards. And all of the main characters, except for the Mila Kunis characters, for the Mila Kunis character, Lily, are personifications of the tarot. For example, Nina Sayers is the moon reversed, and it's reversed because this denotes her lunacy. And she actually says this in the movie. She said, "I've been to the moon and back to the mother." And if you pay attention to when she takes the stage at the end, the moon's in the background. The mother character is the Queen of Swords. The Vincent Leroy character, Thomas Leroy, is the devil card. He's the dark manipulator of the woman. He is always seen in a constant sense of descent, going down a flight of steps in the movie.
Can I just stop you here? I want to talk about this flight of steps thing. Not that I'm trying to pick a fighter or a bone to pick, but you mentioned it a lot of times. Let's talk about it, because it's in The Exorcist and various things. Can it just be a guy is going up and down a staircase? I mean, how do you know that going upstairs means this and going downstairs means that? Can a guy just be moving from one place to another? Does that ever happen? Or are they all symbolically tied and other movies?
No. I mean, some instances, yeah. I mean, there's nothing to this stuff. I mean, you know, if you're watching a movie, and believe me, you know, I've watched the movies of Tim Burton numerous times. I mean, and there's nothing in them.
Not Planet of the Apes, I hope.
Right. I mean, there's nothing in his, there is no esoteric symbology in any of his movies. Quentin Tarantino's another one. I mean, there is nothing in them.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's just nothing to them.
Is that why they're just fun time popcorn shoot up kind of things, and they leave you with a different feeling? Because a lot of these other movies you're talking about, like The Shining and Black Swan, and you know these other ones that are symbologically tied, they do kind of require some kind of mental calisthenics, some kind of kind of tugs on you, makes you feel a certain way when it's over. Whereas if you're just watching a crazy fun time movie, then it's still enjoyable and still a good film, but maybe they're not hitting on all those internal triggers that we may even subliminally be reacting to or subconsciously reacting to.
Right. Well, I mean, Aronofsky's movies, all his movies are generally Kabbalistic and Gnostic. You go back to The Fountain, The Life of Pi, Black Swan. He gives you tip-offs to this throughout the movie with these alchemical themes. The Leroy character, like I said, there could be nothing to this. But you have the character. I mean, one of his great tip-offs for this is the Mila Kunis character, who is named Lily. Lily is named after the female goddess Lilith, who was a trickster goddess, who was a fly-by-night demon goddess. And this is why Lily has the two black demonic wings tattooed on her back. So you can keep an eye out for it. You will start to see it. I've watched numerous movies. You know, it's a great question to ask is this stuff being incorporated into every movie you see? I mean, and no, it isn't. I've seen numerous movies. I've watched them a dozen times. I mean, with the exception of Edward Scissorhands, who is a golem, a creature brought to life by, an inanimate object, invested with human life. By and large, the movies of Tim Burton have nothing to them. Tarantino's another one.
Frankenweenie?
Frankenweenie's Frankenstein. And, of course, Frankenstein's monster is probably the greatest Kabbalistic golem ever created. A golem, for your listeners, it comes out of the Bible. It's a Jewish Hebrew monster that, it's not necessarily a monster. It can be.
That's the goyim.
Yeah, it's dead tissue that's invested with human life and acts human-like. You will see a golem on screen. Frankenstein's monster is probably the most famous golem in cinematic or even literary history.
Okay.
Edward Scissorhands is another one, believe it or not. I'm trying to think of other Pumpkinhead, the movie Pumpkinhead, the demon, the dead demon, which is invested with life. That's a golem. One of the most famous golems in cinematic history, and you're going to take a step back when I say this, probably one of the most famous golems ever created is Smurfette.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Gollum.
No, he is a unique creature.
I know he is. Yeah. Okay, so go back to the surprise again. Smurfette? Is that what you said?
Yeah, Smurfette is a lump of clay that is brought to life by black magic of Gargamel. And Smurfette's, is invested with the life, is created by Gargamel.
Well, what's
Gargamel.
The Smurf then?
And she's
well, where'd her, the Smurf her, come from if the Smurfette is just this dirty little lump of something?
Let me finish the story. Her sole purpose in life is to go into the Smurf communist village and sow discord and chaos, establish a fifth column. I mean, Papa Smurf is Karl Marx. I mean, he wears the red Phrygian hat.
I have to admit, I did not anticipate the discussion going down Smurf Road, and I am thoroughly unprepared to discuss this.
Well, I can back off of it.
No, that's okay. That's okay. No, it's not a criticism of you. I'm just admitting that has not been in my cinematic desirability list,
Loads of people ask me about Walt Disney, children's material, and the Smurfs have it as well. But just I'll wrap it up real quick. A Smurfette is basically created as this golem by Gargamel to go into the Smurf village, destroy it. Papa Smurf catches wind of it and uses white magic and turns Smurfette into a real Smurf. And this is the blonde-haired Smurfette that we all know and love. But originally, Smurfette is a Kabbalistic Frankenstein-like creature created
by
Gargamel.
They're not always as they appear, then. That's for sure. That's not my vision of Smurfette on the lunch bags and knapsacks that I've seen going to school. Oh, my goodness. All right, well, Robert, we'll be right back. And everybody, we have Robert Sullivan IV on the line, and we will continue talking about cinematic symbology in Hollywood films right after this. This is Conspiracy Queries, Channel 167. Okay, thanks for that. We just were getting into the strange, nefarious origins of that blue temptress we all love and know as Smurfette. Wow. Okay, so are there any other you said there were a lot of these types of things in Disney films. Of course, Smurfs aren't a Disney film yet. I'm sure they might acquire them shortly, like everybody else. What other kinds of kids' movies and animated types of things can we talk about this that have this type of symbology, and why are they putting it into kids' movies? That's a loaded question because I got an answer already.
Well, the answer to your question is the Walt Disney material is something I'm reserving for cinema symbolism too, but I will talk about it with you. A lot of the Disney movies, a lot of the cartoon movies, things like Sleeping Beauty, Snow White, are based on the works of the Brothers Grimm. So you can't necessarily lay this at the doorstep of Walt Disney, but you will find some very mystical themes in Walt Disney movies. And directed at children. I'm trying to think, for example, well, just going back to the Royal Arch of Enoch, the two movies I did that I mentioned in Royal Arch of Enoch was National Treasure 1 and National Treasure 2. Those are both Walt Disney movies that are just overloaded with Masonic themes. For example, the first National Treasure movie is the retelling of the Royal Arch ceremonial. It's the location of the...
This is with Nicolas Cage, is that right?
Right. This is the movie with Nick Cage. I want to say it came out in 2004. This is where he finds the Masonic treasure vault beneath the Holy Ground in New York City. If you're familiar with the Royal Arch Ceremonial in Freemasonry, it's the recovery of the treasure vault of Freemasonry on the Holy Ground, on the Temple Mount in the Holy Land. So the National Treasure movie is just a retelling of the Royal Arch Ceremonial. National Treasure 2 has a lot of overarching Freemasonic themes in it as well. Getting back to the Disney children's movies, a lot of this stuff you've got to lay at the doorstep of the Brothers Grimm, but you will find it in the Disney movies. Certainly, and this isn't the Brothers Grimm's, where you have Fantasia, where you have Mickey Mouse as the Sorcerer's Apprentice using the magic to make the broomsticks come alive and dance around. You have Night on Bald Mountain, which is decidedly satanic in origin.
Which mountain is this?
The Fantasia in Disney's Fantasia, right. There's a portion called Night on Bald Mountain,
okay,
which is about about demons coming out of hell and things like that. It's very dark, but you will find it in Disney's Fantasia. Two movies I like to talk about briefly. It's movies I'm dissecting in cinema symbolism too. They came out in the mid 1970s. Is the two Witch Mountain movies? These were movies made for children.
Witch Mountain and. Something? Return?
It's Escape to Witch Mountain and Return from Witch Mountain. Return from Witch Mountain has very adult themes in them, hidden under the guise of a children's movie. This is where Christopher Lee, this is the sequel, this is Return From, where Christopher Lee and Betty Davis try to turn the male star child, Tony, into a Manchurian candidate. And while he's mind controlled by Christopher Lee, he tries to murder his sister. He knocks over a museum and he tries to cause a China syndrome in a nuclear reactor. All that good stuff directed right at children. Great material there. I mean, very adult like. The prequel or the original movie Escape to Witch Mountain has, believe it or not, very illuministic, overarching Masonic themes to them. You have a lot of elements of witchcraft in them, but again, it's contrasted with this notion that the children aren't really witches or part of a coven; they're actually extraterrestrial beings. But the movie plays on this back and forth, and then you have this aristocratic Illuminati type puppet master named Aristotle Bolt, who wants to use the children's powers to foresee the future, do land grabs for oil, cause revolutions. I mean, if this isn't the Illuminati, I don't know what is.
He sounds like he already exists.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, he opens up the movie consulting astrologers, you know, and wants the children's power, you know, to cause, you know, problems in the world. It's interesting. It's an interesting twist because the character, the villain's name is Bolt, which, of course, you know, you bolt the door, you lock people in. But it's a paradox. The guy who wrote the stories they're based upon, which is, his name is Alexander Key. So you have this whole, you know, it's the opposite of Key,
Bolt,
the guy who wrote
right.
the story. And then, of course, you have this Masonic theme going on in Escape to Witch Mountain, where the hero, you know, is trying to help the children get back to Witch Mountain. And he tells them to go stay at, you know, this character's name is Jason O'Day. Of course, O'Day reeks of, you know, sun and light. And he has a brother named, of all things, Hiram O'Day. And, of course, Hiram Abiff is the,
right.
the sun. Yeah, yeah, is the sun man. In blue. Well, he's the sun man of the Blue Lodge. And interestingly, Hiram O'Day is never seen in the movie. He's always missing. This is, of course, in the Blue Lodge ritual. Hiram Abiff goes missing. You know, so you have, you know, and then you've got the little star case that contains the treasure, the hidden occult information as to the true origins of the children. There's a lot more going on in the movies. But, yeah, you have these very sort of Gnostic, Masonic themes going on in Escape 2. And then in Return From, you have this really overarching themes of, you know, mind control, Manchurian candidates, you know.
What is all this telling the person watching it? Just say, you know, an average person watching this thing, what is this telling the person? Because whoever's making this is doing it for a reason, for people to see it. And a lot of people see it and then they buy the DVD and we go on like this. And so what are they trying to hammer home?
Right. It's a great question. And I've been asked it before. And there's really a couple ways you can look at it. One is, you know, a lot of people see this as evidence of, you know, this evil demonic, you know, conspiracy going on in Hollywood of mind control, of things like that. I don't necessarily see it that way. I see it as possible subliminal use by Hollywood executives to convey hidden meanings. This would be no different than artists and architects using sacred geometry in buildings by incorporating this mythological numinous arcana or esoterica. You are transforming a piece of mere celluloid into this esoteric masterpiece.
Sure.
That you know, this is again comes out of the world of Carl Gustav Jung and the collective unconscious, where these filmmakers are damn well aware of this. So they incorporate these astrological, mythological, numerological occult symbols because they know that this plays on the collective unconscious. Alternatively, filmmakers can also be subject to this. I know, and I document this in the book, where a filmmaker may not be aware of this mysticism, yet there it turns up in the film. So the filmmaker may be putting this material in, even unconsciously on their own. So you have a lot of different ways of looking at it. It can be a way of incorporating you know, this mysticism, this mythology into these movies. And by doing that, you're transforming a story or an action adventure story into this sublime mythological masterpiece.
Okay. Let's spend a little time, if possible, on The Lion King. Speaking of Disney, and I know we're talking about Witch Mountain and the Return to and Escape From, but I thought this was a pretty big deal in the 90s symbolically. And I didn't even really know what was going on at that time.
The Lion King, I don't mind talking about it briefly. It's a movie I haven't seen in a while, and it's something I'm taking on in cinema symbolism, too. But it's basically, The Lion King is like Back to the Future. It's the entire retelling of the Osirian cycle of Egypt. It's the Sun King. It's the, you know, the dying and resurrected solar savior, where the original Sun King, this would be the character voiced by James Earl Jones, would be the Osiris character, the replacement. This would be the younger son. The coming, the next one would be the Horus character. This is voiced by Matthew Broderick. And then you have the Scar character, who is obviously Typhon or Set, who is the enemy of the sun, who is always plotting against him. So you have within the Sun King, the Lion King, the entire retelling of the Osirian Egyptian cycle. And of course, this ties into, you know, the sun. Leo is, of course, the lion, the constellation Leo the lion is the sole house of the sun. So you have the entire concept of solar rulership going on with the Lion King. You'll find this in Freemasonry, believe it or not. When Hiram Abiff is resurrected in the Blue Lodge, he is brought back to life. And this comes straight out of Egyptian mythology, where you have the where the candidate as Hiram Abiff is resurrected on what's called the strong grip of a lion's paw. This is a reference to the constellation of Leo the lion, again, Leo being the sole house of the sun. So you have within the Lion King, the Disney movie, this entire retelling of the Egyptian Osirian cycle, you know, where with Osiris, Horus, Set or Typhon. This would be the Scar character, the villainous character. You will find these Egyptian motifs in the Back to the Future movies. You will find these in Star Wars, where the Luke Skywalker character, for example, Luke, I mean, and you know, the Star Wars movies come straight out of the world of Joseph Campbell. If you and your listeners aren't familiar with that name.
Sure, the myths,
I mean, he was basically an American mythologist and symbolist. And Lucas has said on numerous occasions that Star Wars was based on his teachings. So you have Luke Skywalker. The name Luke comes from Lux, meaning light, and light sky walking, the sun. The sun walks across the sky. He does battle with the Set or Sith lords, which would be Seth or Set in the Egyptian mythology. These are the lords of darkness. And of course, you know, Luke Skywalker being the sun god, Horus or Apollo. You know, the sun has the lunar sister, Diana. This would be, you know, Princess Leia, who is always clothed in the white robes of the moon. So you have this entire, you know, solar Egyptian motif going on in Star Wars. You actually, believe it or not, and it's hard to believe, and we won't have time for it. I documented extensively in the book, but the Back to the Future trilogy is decidedly Egyptian. The entire McFly family is, again, a retelling of the Egyptian Osirian cycle, who do battle with the god Typhon, who is Biff Tannen, who is their archenemy, you know, and the
Biff.
McFly, you know, and the McFly family. I mean, where do the McFlys live? Lion Estate, Leo the Lion, the Sun family. The whole 88 miles an hour is a solar allegory. But I get into this in the book with the entire Back to the Future trilogy. Star Wars has it, and yeah, you know, yes, certainly the Lion King, the Disney movie has it as well.
Well, that's amazing. Well, speaking of Osiris and Horus and all of that in Egyptian history and symbology that they weave in. On that note, and I know this isn't necessarily on the topic of films, not yet anyway, but what do you make of what we are told is now ISIS?
What you're talking about, the guys over the guys who call themselves ISIS over in bombing Iraq right now?
Yeah, like Coke Zero is Al Qaeda, and now there's ISIS, this new, even more powerful cola that'll scrub your
toilet. What's ISIS stand for them? ISIS, Iraq, Syria,
yeah,
Islamic State, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny name to use. You know, I've seen on Twitter some of the people I follow saying, hey, you know, isn't this bothering people that these guys who are trying to establish this Islamic State are using the name of this Egyptian Virgin Mother?
Very fascinating. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but they seem to be anti-Masonic. I know they just issued a statement saying that Barack Obama is a puppet of the Masons and the Knights Templar, and that ISIS is, I mean, this is the Islamic ISIS, is trying to fight off the Freemasons and the Templars who, you know, are backing Israel to create this, you know, Zionistic Masonic state in the Middle East, and they're fighting it. But yeah, it is a weird name to take for that. I don't know if it was intentionally done by them or not.
I don't know. It's just starting to spin out of control now. You got a British guy on the video that supposedly killed, you know, James Foley. It's a British guy. Now they've come out with, well, they don't deny that James was murdered, but they do, you know, the film has all been manipulated and flipped around, and they can tell this, you know, forensically it's no problem. It's like, oh, can we just get straight on this stuff for once? I mean, you know, can we get some truth out of this? They have to manipulate everything. And it's like, why? You know, why can't we just understand why they have to do things like that?
Yeah, I haven't seen the video of the execution. I haven't seen it, so I really wouldn't offer comment on it. But it is sort of a weird name. I know some of the people, like I said, I follow on Twitter who are into astrology, you know, and Egyptian mythology and comparative religion have said, you know, isn't this bothering people? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I agree with them. But yeah, I mean, it is, you know, I'm surprised that more people haven't picked up on that these guys are using this Egyptian.
It just seems,
you know,
completely misplaced, and that couldn't possibly, like, remember when they got really upset at George Bush for calling it a crusade? You know, when they invaded there. Oh, no, that's not what I meant. I didn't mean like we're picking on the Muslims, which is kind of exactly, you know, what they were targeting.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
You know,
well,
I mean,
well, that's what's funny is, though, and I think I saw this. I mean, I think this was legitimate. I mean, I'd have to go check, but I want to say I know on Facebook some of the Freemasons that I'm friends with had put this up on their wall. But I think that, you know, they said that, you know, ISIS, this is the Islamic ISIS again, not the goddess in Egypt.
Not the TV show.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Had issued this anti-Masonic, anti-Templar statement, and these guys are basically taking the guise, you know, that Israel is this Masonic state, Barack Obama is a puppet of the Masons and the Templars, and that these guys are going to fight it to the death. I don't know what's going on.
Well, not all of that sounds crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean,
But
yeah, I don't know what's going on.
Oh, well, that's a good place to pause then. And yeah, we'll possibly just take a second here, and we'll try to shake this nonsense out of our heads, folks, and we'll be right back with Robert Sullivan. So how do you watch a movie, Robert, when you sit down at a theater, or if you're, you know, however you watch them? Do you have this eye out all the time to see, okay, what's going on with this film, and then start finding things?
Yeah, it's a great question to ask. It goes back to when I was writing Royal Arch of Enoch, and what really was one of the, you know, this was, you know, back in the mid-2000s was when I watched the National Treasure movie. That's when I started really getting tipped off to this, that there was this whole esoteric mythological underpinning in a lot of movies, and just doing the research on it, like I said, studying Kabbalah, numerology, astrology, yada yada yada. You know, when you look at it for 20 years, you could start applying it to movies. By and large, if I'm just watching a movie passively.
Right now?
No. Well,
I'd like your complete focus and attention, please.
Well, if I'm just watching a movie passively, no, I'm not paying attention. But if I catch something going on in a movie, what I usually do is for me to analyze it, I get the movie on DVD or Blu-ray.
And
then I sit. I sit literally with a legal pad and my pause button.
But I mean, you've got a hunch on this movie in the first place, or are you just going to throw in anything?
Yeah, yeah, I can have a hunch on it. Sometimes when I'm watching a movie, I will see things that they've picked up on from other movies. I'm a movie buff. I mean, you know, other than probably occult Freemasonry, movies is my other big, you know, thing in life. I'm a movie junkie.
Well, that's handy.
Yeah. I'm literally a movie junkie. I've seen everything, and you know, I haven't seen everything, but I've seen a lot of movies, and it's really one of my pastimes. You know,
okay.
Watching,
let me throw you a curveball then. Have you seen this movie called "My Girlfriend Did Not Want to See Horror Movies"? She's not into it, so I tricked her into seeing a movie. You know, one night DVD, couch, popcorn, all that. And I said, it's a chick flick. You know, these girls, they get together once a year, and it's kind of fun. They just do different stuff. And the movie I was telling her about and then showed her, and she's furious at me forever for doing it, is called The Descent.
The Descent. I have not seen it.
Oh, check it out. Talk about going up and down staircases and vertical. And here's what happens. These gals get together. You should check it out, because with what you know about this symbology, I think this is something you might like. As about five or six women, something like this, and every year they get together, these gals, to do like a girls' weekend kind of thing. And they, you know, go horseback riding one year and then off to France to do stuff another year. So this particular show, the movie, is about the year they get together to go spelunking into caves, you know, digging around in caves and stuff.
Right.
And so they literally, that's the descent going down into the cave. And then the caves start getting really tight and weird, and then some shifting happens. They kind of get trapped in there. And the only way is to keep on going down, they figure, because the way they came got sort of avalanched over.
Okay.
And it's already scary as hell enough as it is. And then they encounter these kind of guys who are have been living down there, human-type folks, humanoids, and they've been down there so long they've all of a sudden morphed and adapted into, like, mole people where they can't really see, but they can find you, and they got, like, wicked teeth, and they're deadly killers and all this. And so on top of the fact that these gals are stuck in caves that are – they can't get out of, these monster people are in there. And I bet you'd find it fascinating with what you know about this kind of thing.
Well, I'd have to definitely watch the movie. I really couldn't all.
Well, I recommend it. Like, it's a good one. You know, it's a popcorn muncher. Yeah. It's a thriller, and you might get something out of it.
Yeah, I'll definitely put it on my list to check out. Well, I'm writing Cinema Symbolism 2 right now, and I'm doing some more horror movies and stuff. So it's definitely I'll definitely have to check it out. But like I said, not having seen it, I couldn't offer comment on it. But I'll definitely make sure I check it out. Horror movies do have a lot of unique things in them. Not all of them do. We were talking about, I know earlier we were talking about The Exorcist. Another series of horror movies that I do in Cinema Symbolism, where I analyze, is the Three Omen movies. Those things are over the top.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, those things are, where do you want to start?
Well, you put The Exorcist as probably one of your favorite horror movies. So where would you put the Omen trilogy? I got to say, I never really kind of took into that one. So I wasn't aware of its impact.
Yeah, the Omen movies are like Christianity. They are the polar opposite. The Antichrist comes to power when you're watching those movies, especially the second one and even the third one, which is just so overloaded with astrology. We don't have time for it. But when what these movies do, they're decidedly Egyptian. They incorporate a lot of the whole thing with the sun, dark and light. The second Omen, I like the movies. Just to answer your question. The first one is by far and away the best one. I like all three of them. I've seen them all numerous times. I actually have them here on DVD or Blu-ray. I have them in one of the versions. Yeah. But I like all three of the Omen movies. I guess The Exorcist is probably my favorite all-time horror movie.
Yeah.
I like The Shining. That's a movie I'm doing in Cinema Symbolism 2. I talk about it in Cinema Symbolism 1. That thing is just so overloaded.
Okay,
That is just Stanley Kubrick on, numerological repetition steroids. I've never seen anything. What's that?
That sounds uncomfortable, but yeah.
I have never seen, a movie that repeats itself. I mean, all it is it's just, it repeats. It's just a never-ending cycle of repetition.
So? Give me an example.
Well, I mean, it's the whole movie. I mean, it's from start to finish. What Kubrick does is, in order to convey, and I imagine this ticks Stephen King off, because
yes,
all Kubrick does is repeat the movie over and over again, and he just uses the same numbers and the same symbols. I'm familiar with the moon landing launch thing with the little boy with the Apollo thing in that. I won't get into that, but I am familiar with it. But you have this whole numerological thing of repetition. I mean, where do you want to start? Okay, the movie begins where it ends. The Jack Torrance character is going up the road towards the Overlook. The road that he is traveling on is called Going to the Sun Road, of all things, which was built in 1921. The movie ends in 1921. When you're shown the photo of him on the 4th of July, July 4th, 1921, let's see, repetition. It takes him 3.5 hours to get to the Overlook. 210 minutes is 3.5 hours, 21. The photo at the end is in a grouping of 21 photos, 21 again. It's never ending doubles, Alan. Believe me, that's all this movie is never ending doubles. The little boy is introduced wearing the number 42 on his T-shirt, on his shirt.
21 twice.
42 is on the license plate of Scatman Crothers driving back to the hotel in the snowstorm. The movie that Danny and Wendy watch in the Overlook is The Summer of 42.
Oh, my goodness. Holy cow. You remember the scene where the kid's watching a Looney Tunes cartoon, I think?
He's watching the Roadrunner.
That's
right. One of the ones he's watching.
Yeah, I wonder. I just wondered if there was anything in there that, it seems like every single detail is part of something. And I was just wondering, as a Roadrunner fan,
Well, but, repetition, doubles. The hotel is built in 2 years, 1907 to 1909. Two little girls haunt it who are twins,
right,
who are 2 years. And then he tells them they're 2 years apart, 8 and 10. The series, the whole movie moves forward in 2 days. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Monday, Wednesday, every 2 days. The number 12, and this ties into the astrological alchemy going on, is all over the place in The Shining.
The number 12.
The number 12, Jack Torrance hits the bathroom door 12 times. He throws the ball against the wall 12 times. Wendy Torrance flips through 24 pages, 12 times two, of the manuscript that has All
right.
Work, No
All
Play
work
written
and no
on
play.
It.
A great scene, a great scene.
How about this? The room, 237, add them up, and you get the number 12. Multiply them, and you get 42. Going back to the four, I mean, this is all this movie is repetition, doubles, over and over again. You'll see it in every damn scene of the thing.
The guy that meets him in the bathroom tells him, and now you got to go out and kill your kids just like he did.
Right. What Kubrick is symbolically showing you is this vicious cycle of reincarnation going on in the Overlook that never ends. It's incapable of ending. That's what he is symbolically showing you by using this. Again, doubles. Wendy tends to the two boilers. Jack Torrance uses two typewriters. You probably aren't aware
right.
of that. There are two tennis balls, one green that he throws around. Then when the little boy's playing with the toy, a little pink one rolls in.
Right.
This is because the mother's favorite color is pink. And when he sees the pink tennis ball, he says, "Mom." So he identifies that with her. How about the casting? You want to talk about doubles? Jack Nicholson plays Jack Torrance. Danny Lloyd plays Danny Torrance.
Oh, wow.
Shelley Duvall, two L's in her first name, two L's in her last name. The architect of the Gold Room is Frank Lloyd Wright. The bartender is Lloyd. There you have the double
right.
of Lloyd again. I mean, it's endless.
Sameness of Lloyd.
Yeah,
right.
it's just an endless spiral of twos and doubles going on in the Overlook Hotel. I mean, and you know, you'll see it in every scene. It'll drive you crazy. I've got a whole.
And you know what else I've noticed about that film, and this buys right into it, what you're saying. Maybe I'm having a bit of a revelation as a fan of the film, but so much of the so many of the shots, like down the halls and these types of things, are so symmetrical. And it's like, okay, so you had something
right.
with a mirror in the middle of it, and it would sort of reflect it back like that too.
Yeah, absolutely. You have Kubrick doing what Aronofsky does with the mirrors, with the reflection of the darker self. When Jack Torrance is demon possessed and he talks to the little boy, you'll
yeah.
see his reflection in the mirror.
Yeah, you know, I'd never hurt you, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. That's
yeah.
exactly right. You have getting back to doubles. You have you have two African American actors in the movie, Scatman Crothers. I forget the other guy's name who runs the modem mechanics. There's only two of them in the movie.
Right.
When they're going back to the number 12, when Danny and Shelley Duvall are in the maze, they take exactly 12 turns in the maze.
Oh.
That's the kind
of thing you got to watch it many times for to see. I'm not going to notice how many times somebody turns and how many times somebody throws a ball on the wall, et cetera, on a first viewing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You got to watch it over and over again. And again, you know,
also repetition.
It's also repetition. How about with the Overlook Hotel? And this is something I talk about in Cinema Symbolism, and you may have picked up on this. The entire Overlook Hotel is a symbol of the United States of America, where it's built on the Indian burial ground. All the people who come there are the presidents, the movie stars, the opulent people. All the characters wear nothing but red, white, and blue clothing throughout the whole movie. When you meet Stuart Allman, he has on the red, white, and blue. When you meet Danny and Wendy Torrance, they have the red, white, and blue on Allman's desk is the little American flag. When Wendy and Danny are going into the maze. They say we got to keep America clean. And of course, this is symbolizing the, you know, Overlook as the United States being built on the Indian nations, just as the Overlook, is built upon, the Indian burial ground, thus the United States symbolically buried the Indians. And then you'll have, this is played out with the two weapons in the movie where the baseball bat is the great American pastime, but Torrance uses the American Indian tomahawk or the axe to try to kill them with. So you have this internal conflict of doubles, America versus the Indian nation going on as well. It's just a fascinating movie, and it's one of my all-time favorites. And Kubrick just goes off the top.
Because Shelley Winters also, Shelley Winters has the bat. When he's trying to get her up the stairs, he says, give me the bat, give me the bat, and she's swinging it at him.
Right, the two weapons the two weapons are the baseball bat of America, the America's pastime, and the axe or the tomahawk of the Indians.
Right.
Those are the only two weapons in the movie. You'll have that whole play going on. It's a great movie, and it's just, repetition over and over again. I talk about The Shining in cinema symbolism, but I was so overwhelmed with it that I'm doing it again in cinema symbolism too. But yeah, it's a great movie.
Okay. And give us, if you got a few more minutes, give us anything a little more recent. I know we were just talking about Black Swan earlier, but if there's anything kind of current, I don't know what you ever make of the Marvel films like The Avengers. There must be a ton of stuff in there.
Right. Well, I talk about briefly. I don't talk about briefly. I get into some of the, talk about modern movies. I talk about, you get into like Batman. We could talk, which has a lot of the archetypical characters in it, where the Joker is the devil character. You know, the Batman himself is the split personality of Bruce Wayne. This is his shadow self. A lot of the Batman characters come out of mythology. Two-Face is Janus, the two-headed god of Greek mythology or Roman mythology. Catwoman is, again, this female trickster goddess Lilith, the darker side of Sophia, who is this goddess of wisdom. So you'll find that going on in the Batman movies and in the Batman mythology in general. This was created by Bob Kane, but this plays out in the Nolan movies. You'll see these archetypical characters probably at their best in the Chris Nolan movies. Modern movies that have this, Fight Club is another one. That's another one of my favorite movies.
Sure.
This has a lot of Gnostic strains in it. And I'm just going to paraphrase this very briefly. This has to do with Valentinian Gnosticism, Valentinian was a Gnostic philosopher who talked about the chosen ones, how they abandoned materialism and how they, embrace spiritualism by abandoning the material world. You'll find this in Fight Club with the space monkeys, what you would want to call the spiritual exercises of Tyler Durden, for lack of a better word, who is trying to destroy the material world, yet has to select all male followers of people who are embracing the spiritual. By embracing the spiritual, they're abandoning the material. And this is symbolized at the end by the destruction of the buildings. Interestingly, you will have in Fight Club, a secret society, Freemasonic motif going on, where
really?
Gotta
see that again.
Where Tyler Durden, if you think about it, Tyler Durden runs this all male secret society. This is, of course, paralleling Freemasonry. Like Freemasonry, you don't talk about its secrets. You don't talk about the secrets of Fight Club. Fight Club has the sacred temple on Paper Street, where in order to gain admission, you got to stand outside for 3 days. Of course, the 3 days parallel the 3 degrees of Freemasonry. And of all things, the guy who guards the Masonic Lodge, who stands outside the Masonic door, the keeper of Freemasonry, of all things, is called the Tyler. So therefore, Tyler Durden guards the secrets, being the Tyler of Fight Club.
Well, it could be just an accident, It could just be a random coincidence. Have you ever considered this?
Well, that's the counter argument to all this. It's all
I know, but how many of those can you tolerate mathematically, though?
You can't tolerate it. I mean, when you see this over and over again, let's be honest. Maybe there are some instances where the filmmaker isn't aware of this material but is incorporating it.
Yeah, and but again, thing I mean, after thing after thing on some of these, I mean, come on. They're obviously in there deliberately by somebody's hand.
I'll give you a perfect example of this. I mean, I agree with you. I think it's being intentionally done, and I think these guys are very familiar with this mysticism. I'll just go on with these two stories,
sure.
Three stories, just real quick
three.
If I can.
Okay, sure.
No, well, in Hollywood, a stone's throw from Hollywood, you have Manly Palmer Hall's Philosophical Research, Philosophical Research Society, which is a library dedicated to occult, esoteric, and Masonic studies. This is literally, I'm not kidding you, a stone's throw from Hollywood and the movie-making industry.
Right.
So you can't tell me these guys aren't familiar with this. Two, and I'll just tell this story real quick. Back when the X-Files was on TV, this was back in the 90s, one of the actors who played one of the lone gunmen, these were the conspiracy guys that helped Mulder and Scully out, one of them told this story. He said, I went into the screenwriter or the producer's office. I had to get input on the character, motivation. He said, I went into their office, and on their bookshelves, he said, I was expecting to find books on how to write screenplays about Hollywood. He said all the books were books by Manly P. Hall about Madame Blavatsky, Aleister Crowley, the occult, mysticism. He said, so these guys are all well-versed in this stuff. And then the other thing was, you know, to answer your question, we're beyond coincidence here. This stuff is intentionally done. You can craft the argument to me that maybe some of these guys are being influenced by the collective unconscious, are subconsciously placing it in because they're victim to it. Well, not victim to it, but they're being influenced
subject
by it as well.
To it as well, yeah.
I'm just going to – I'll go on just with this final story.
Sure.
You talk about, you know, an accident where a guy has no knowledge of this mysticism, no knowledge of this arcana, and I talk about it in the book, is a movie producer. He's a real guy. They made a movie about his life in the 90s. His name was Ed Wood. He was the B-movie director.
Terrible film director.
He was considered this horrible movie director in one of his movies. In fact, it's the first movie he ever made, and I'm just going to go over this briefly. In Gnosticism, there's this character called the Demiurge, who is this lesser god. He's the lesser creator god. He's not the spiritual. He's the material. If you want to see the Gnostic Demiurge on screen, one of the best examples I can think of is the Ed Wood movie Glenn or Glenda, where Bela Lugosi plays the Gnostic Demiurge. He's the lesser god. He's the god of the material world. He's the puppet master who pulls the strings. There is no way Ed Wood was familiar with this, yet there is Bela Lugosi as a Gnostic Demiurge. I mean, and if you went back in time and said to Ed Wood in 1953, hey, why did you cast Lugosi as the Demiurge? Wood wouldn't have known what the hell it is you're talking about.
Right.
Yet there is a Gnostic Demiurge. In fact, it's probably the best example of it I can think of in one of his movies, and that is clearly coming out of the world of Carl Gustav Jung, the collective unconscious, which is in turn a descendant, for lack of a better word, of Plato's theory of forms, the things like astrology, magic, sorcery, religion, the archetypes, good, bad, night, dark, is all just consciously and unconsciously embedded in our psyche, and there's nothing we can do about it.
No. Except be aware of it and understand they do throw it at us, right?
And that's correct. And I agree with you 100%. And when you got the symbolic eye to see this stuff and you study tarot cards, numerology, the occult, mysticism, you know, and I, like I said, I've been looking at it for 20 years. You will see this stuff. You won't see it everywhere, but you will definitely find these themes in movies. And they are there. And I agree with you, Alan. I don't think it's by accident.
No. Hey, Robert Sullivan IV, it's been great having you on. And when you are with the other, have you ever been with the other three Robert Sullivans, like having a meal or something? Say, you know, hey, pass the potatoes, Rob. Okay, sure. Thanks, Rob.
No. The Robert Sullivan I Sr. Died before I was born.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Robert Sullivan Jr. II. He was around during my lifetime. He passed away, I want to say, in 1980. He's been gone for a long time. And right now, Robert Sullivan IV, that's me, and Robert Sullivan III, my father, we are still around. And yes, we talk to each other, but I just call him Dad.
And is your son's name Robert also?
I don't have any children.
Ah, okay. Well, if
maybe
you did, would
day.
You name him? Would you name him Robert if you did?
Well, if it was a female, I would not.
Well,
but,
no, maybe Roberta. Yeah.
Well, no, I'll cross that bridge if and when I ever come to it.
All right, well, maybe there'd be a book about that sometime also. Listen,
sure.
Robert, thanks for coming on again. It was great. Are you going to be writing another book after the part two of the book you're writing now?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking, Alan. I'm actually, as we speak right now, I'm actually writing three books at once, believe it or not.
I believe you're doing that and speaking to me at the same time. That's what I believe.
I am actually writing Cinema Symbolism is out right now, and so is Royal Arch. You can buy those. I am writing Cinema. I'm writing three books at once right now. I'm writing Cinema Symbolism 2, which is the sequel to Cinema Symbolism. I'm writing my first work of fiction, and I'm also writing another book on esoteric Freemasonry. The way I work is, I write one, I get tired of it, and I move on to another one. I start writing that for a while, get a little bored with that, then I go to another one, get tired with that, I go back to one. So I'm just writing three at the same time and just interchanging the work habits on, you know, I'll work on one a couple days, then go to another one, then go to the other one, and that's what I'm doing right now.
Well, that sounds like you're keeping yourself busy and you're watching all these fantastic movies and finding all these connections as well, which is, I don't know how you squeeze all that time in a day. Robert, you are a movie enthusiast and a Freemason. What a fascinating combination. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Al, for having me on Conspiracy Theories. I really appreciate it. It was a great show, and I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, no problem. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Please offer comments or complaints by emailing conspiracyqueries@gmail.com or on Twitter @con_queries or at our website, conspiracyqueries.com. Thanks for listening.